My name is Courtney Perry. I'm an Atlanta attorney. I also teach at Emory Law School in intellectual property areas. I have taught at Temple Law School as well and over at the Emory Business School. And I've practiced here with a big firm for a while and on my own right now, doing mainly smaller artist work at this point. Today we'll be talking about just copyright basics. And I want to start out copyright basics by giving us a basic idea of what copyright is, which generally also includes what it is not. So we have an intellectual property, also called IP. So if you hear me saying IP, I'm talking about intellectual property, not IT, which would be probably how where a lot of y'all work. Intellectual property is generally made up of three different areas: trademarks, patents, and copyrights. Patents are stuff that actually I don't do. Patent law requires you to be a member of the patent bar. It's a separate bar exam, and you have to have a hard science background. If any of y'all are considering getting patents for some of your work, if you're actually inventors or have software that would rise to the level of a patentable work, the standards for patents are very high. And but to get a patent, it is expensive, takes a long time, and you do need a lawyer. It is malpractice to represent yourself as a patent lawyer if you are not. If you are talking to a lawyer about helping you write a patent, ask that lawyer whether he or she is a member of the patent bar. There are a number of just general patent services that lawyers can give without being patent lawyers technically. Don't hire one of them anyway. Don't hire me to do your patents because I would stink at it. Patents are very difficult, and if you don't do them correctly, what you get at the end of the process will either be nothing or worthless. So it's worth. And for that, you need a lawyer, and you need a patent lawyer, and they are a different breed. The standing joke amongst attorneys is that if we were any good at math and science, we'd be doctors. The exception to that is patent lawyers, who are in fact good at both math and science and still made it through law school. They frighten us.
Like my brother.
There are some of them out in the free world, and they are scary to us because we don't understand how they can do that much with just one brain. But regardless, that's what you need if you want a patent. I'm not going to talk about patents today, both because I'm not one of those and because the topic's copyright. But patents need to be distinguished from copyright. They are inventions. Patents are machines. They're processes. They're the real hardcore science stuff that matters. If you get a patent, you can keep anyone else from using it. This is different from copyright protection. So the difference in the three different areas, the protection, the scope of the protection you get is different. People often hear about the rights you have under a patent and just kind of in their mind extrapolate that over to the rights you have under copyrights. Doesn't work that way. So patents, again, expensive, real science, inventions, stuff like that. The patent system, by the way, is really a mess. It's not working the way it's supposed to. Patents are being issued for things that were never under God's earth intended to be patentable. So if you are planning to get a patent, good luck with that. It may issue, it may not. It'll cost you a lot of money to get there. Trademarks are something else altogether also. Trademarks are often confused with copyright, but they are also very different both in the scope of protection and how you go about getting them. A trademark is not the book you write. It is not the art you do. It is the name under which your goods and or services are offered. I usually have a can of someone's product in my hand when I teach, but here we go. If I hold up a fairly recognizable pen, what kind of pen is that?
Sharpie.
It's a Sharpie. Sharpie does not mean just that it will write on any damn thing. It means the people who make this pen are Sharpie. If I buy a Sharpie, I know what I'm getting. And I know that if I'm wearing light-colored clothing, I should not take the cap off because I will ruin my clothes. Trademarks are done, unlike what most people think, not to protect the goodwill and the value of the company, but trademarks are in our laws to protect you, the consumer, so that when you buy a felt tip pen, you know, good God, yes, it will write on anything. If you buy a can of bubbly caramel colored soda, you know which kind it is. If you are in Atlanta, you have a pretty good guess anyway, but you can be certain based on the name on the outside of the can and or cup. When you buy it, you know what you're getting. So the whole point of trademark is to distinguish the source of goods and services. If I buy something off the shelf at the grocery store, if I buy a car, no matter what I buy, I know where it's coming from. This protects me from thinking I'm buying a high quality product and not. This protects me from buying companies I don't choose to buy from. And it's just easier because if I see the red can, I know what I'm getting. I don't have to actually read the label. We're lazy by nature. We prefer not to have to think. trademark helps us along in that way. Trademarks do not cover the substance of a work. They can be the logo. They can be the color if it's used in a distinctive fashion. Color alone is not usually sufficient for trade dress, but used in some ways it is. Red for cola is a generic designation. No one gets to own that anymore. But pink for fiberglass insulation is, in fact, that was one of the big cases when they first said, okay, color can be enough. Owens Corningware, their fiberglass insulation is pink for no reason other than because that way we know it's theirs. The rest of it's kind of an insipid beige color. If it's pink, it's a brand identifier because there's no other reason for that color. Orange juice coming in an orange container, yeah, not so much. For a long time, Minute Maid actually was the only one who, they owned the trade dress use of black on their Minute Maid drinks, which was considered distinctive enough to be allowed for them because one of the big rules of marketing is never use black as a food color. Black is death in most people's mind. It's not what they want on the label of their food. Coke broke that rule, and now if you look, Kroger does the same thing, so everyone does the same thing. But for a while, that was sufficiently distinctive that Coke owned it. Trademarks are filed with the federal government, if you have any sense. Just by using a name, you get some rights. By filing it, you get many more. If you are thinking of filing your name or your company's name or your product's name to protect it so other people cannot use your name, you would be an idiot if you did not go ahead with the federal trademark registration process. $325, I think, for the process. Might be $350, I always forget. But it's one of those numbers. If you are trying to file a trademark, you can do that without a lawyer. You need to have a little bit of patience because the form online is not exactly intuitive, and some of the things in there are really written for my people, not for you. But it is doable. If you have a little bit of sense, you can work your way through the trademark application without hiring a lawyer. And it's all online, uspto.gov. You can work through it. It'll hurt a little bit since you don't know how to do it, but you can accomplish it. One thing to keep in mind, this is just the practice pointer for the day. With trademarks, if you are filing one, and I promise I'm going to copyright in just a second. If you're doing the trademark filing yourself, there, when you're going through the whole this screen, that screen, and work your way through, there's one point where you get to choose which type of filing you're doing, and there's two different price levels, basically. You can do it for $100 cheaper, or you can pay the $325, which is the full form as opposed to the, I forget what they call it. Basically, the distinction is one of them is, yeah, I'm doing my best, and I think I've got it, but here you go, $300-something, do that one. There's another one that's like 200 and something. It's basically $100 off the price. You'll be tempted to do that. Do not. The one, the cheaper price one is one that basically says, I am so dead certain I know exactly what I'm doing that there is no way I could possibly be making a mistake, and the descriptive language that I am using is just dead on gospel correct. It won't be. You will not get it right. No one gets it right. But if you do the cheap form, they will not do what they normally do, which is send it back saying, well, you said dark blue, but that's more of a medium blue, so you need to replace that with medium blue. And you said through telephonic services, it needs to be on telephonic services, otherwise your trademark won't issue. The trademark examining attorneys are actually usually very helpful and very nice, but good God, they're picky about stupid shit. But they will come up with something that has to be different, and if you pay the full $325, then they will send you a little email saying you have to change these things, and you say, fine, and then your trademark issues 6 months later. If you go through a cheaper one, they'll go, oh, that was wrong, fail, and that's the end of the process. So don't be tempted by the cheap one. Do the full price one, and there's your trademark. Trademarks last forever as long as you use them. So as long as you continue to use the name Coca-Cola, Coca-Cola will continue to be your trademark. I do not actually suggest any of you use Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola's trademark lawyers are some of the meanest people in the world. Actually, not so much mean, just they're good at their jobs.
Persistent, ruthless.
Ruthless would be a good word. We used to say that the ultimate cage match would not be, you know, Superman and Batman or that nonsense. It would be the Coke trademark lawyers against the Disney trademark lawyers. We don't know who would come out of that cage, but my God, it would be good watching. Don't mess with the mouse. Don't take on the Red Tower. Neither one will go well for you. Yes?
You said as long as you use it, what's the kind of area to what would be
I don't know. That one is very fact-dependent. I'm sure there's... I honestly have not looked up the latest cases on that issue, so I could make up something that would sound like a reasonable answer, but I honestly don't know the specific answer to that. Yeah?
I was wondering, if I were to create a name for a book that I'm doing, mm-hmm. do I have a trademark that name?
Usually the trademark office will not accept book titles. Sometimes they do. It depends. They're more inclined to accept that if it's of a series. So it's still indicating source, just a book title, sometimes not. Really, all you need to do if you're writing a book is to go for the copyright. That's sufficient. If you're going to use the title over time for a full series, then maybe it's worth it. But trademark, not necessarily just for a book title. However, a book title, we're getting just about to that, is not copyrightable. It's part of your book. The work itself is protected under copyright. But short names, short phrases, identifiers like that are not protectable under copyright. The whole work is your titles of your chapters, for instance, are not copyrighted individually. The text of your title for your book is also not.
So if I decide to do like a comic book, mm-hmm. and it's a normal issue, then it's a trademark.
I have seen that done. It may well be worthwhile doing. Yeah?
When a question is asked, can you repeat the question so we can hear what the question was because the voices don't travel back?
Sure. She asked if there was a question, if I could repeat it so that everyone in the room would hear it.
You trademarked the name of a business that's being used by someone else was not trademarked that particular name. Was your trademark stamped?
No.
Not.
Lawyers will get very rich off of you, and you'll at the end of the day be messed up. Since he has to be back, I assume you actually could hear that. The question basically is on precedence of trademarks. If someone else is using a trademark, and they have not filed their federal protection, because they didn't hear me at the beginning of the class say, don't be a moron, go file your damn trademark. If they did not follow that basic legal advice, they still have some rights to their trademark. Wherever they geographically are using it, they continue to have the right to do so. If they have been using it nationwide, they have nationwide rights. This law is obviously back from the days when people had small geographic areas in which they sold things. Now it's very difficult to find a business that doesn't sell in at least a large area because we have this clever little thing called the internet where everyone can buy anything. But if it really is like a corner restaurant that sells things on that corner, they would have the right to keep you from using that name in a reasonable geographic area around that if it's for the same kind of product. So it depends greatly on the circumstances of it, but you do get rights even if you don't file. They are limited geographically, but the first user does get rights. So if you have come up with a clever name for yourself, for your company, for your book titles, whatever, you need to search and see if someone else is using it. There is an easy Boolean logic kind of search engine on the trademark side. Again, it's uspto.gov. It's the, I think TEAS is the acronym for the forms, and TESS, so it's tests and T's. I'm not sure what they're getting at there. But the test form is their basic searchable engine. It searches the whole trademark database. Very straightforward to use. Also, Google the hell out of it. I don't need to tell y'all how to do internet searches, but do more than just Google. Do a couple of different search engines because you get different results. Before you get all excited about keeping this name that you've fallen in love with, check and make sure no one else owns it. And again, even if they haven't filed the federal trademark registration, they do have common law rights if they have been using it in commerce. Yes?
I saw an SM where I might have expected a TM. The other day, what is SM?
SM is a service mark. That means that instead of selling goods, they're selling a service. So I'm coming to clean your house rather than I'm coming to sell you the carpets for it. Or I'm going to clean your carpets rather than sell you the carpets would have been the more parallel analogy. But, yeah, I don't have my call.
Is there a difference?
Functionally, no. Yes, there are many differences, but no. Okay, that's trademark. Also, not what we're talking about today. Copyright is what we're here to talk about. Copyright is for the arts and the books and the poetry and the software. That was another lecture, not even this year, about why it's just incredibly dumb that software is covered by copyright. You will find lots of problems if you are trying to get your software protected by copyright because the entire copyright structure just wasn't meant for software. And it does not fit well and does not protect you well. If you are trying to protect your software in particular, good luck with that because there is nothing right now that does a very good job of it. Copyright, however, does a great job of a lot of things. It was intended, it is in the Constitution, it was intended by the Founding Fathers along with patents to be given as a limited time monopoly to inventors and writers and artists to encourage the production of useful sciences, arts, writings, all that good stuff. The Founding Fathers noticed that they had just overthrown the aristocracy and they were not establishing a church to run the country. That just took away pretty much everyone who paid for art up to that point. So no one was going to be inventing because they just got rid of the landed gentry who didn't have to work for a living. No one was going to be paying lots of money for the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel to be painted because they opted not to give control of the government to a church. So lacking any of the traditional sources funding for invention and art, they said we better come up with something. Clever men that they were opted for a market solution. If we give people a way to profit from this, then they will find a way to do it. Lo and behold, they did. So copyright is intended, again, not to protect your work. Just like trademark is not intended to make Coke happy, it's for your benefit. Copyright is really not intended to protect your right to your property. It is intended to encourage you to produce it in the first place. It's a, okay, if we throw you some money, will you please write something? It's the government's bribe to you to be creative and useful. Yes?
Were trademark patents and copyrights actually originated?
The question was about the origination of trademarks, copyrights, and patents, whether in the Constitution or not. All of them predated the Constitution in some form or other. History of patents, actually, I'm not even dead clear on. But copyright started with the Statute of Anne, which was in England long before our country existed. Copyrights basically came into existence with the advent of the printing press. The content industry has been upset by new technology since Gutenberg. Prior to Gutenberg, the only one who could make books were the monks with their pens and making the pretty pictures on the corners. And if you had to be a monk to write a book, it was kind of a tough trade-off, but what they did anyway. So you had the church-controlled writings, and they were pretty happy about that. Along comes this upstart twit Gutenberg, and now anyone could have a book. This won't do. And the church said, but other people could write things. And people who were writing said, but other people could print them. It's not just monks with pens anymore. Oh God, the earth's coming to an end. No one will ever write a book again. They repeated that theory when the Xerox machine came into effect, and a whole lot of other inventions along the way have shaken the content media greatly. Perhaps that sounds familiar today. But the so copyright has been evolving since Statute of Anne, which was older than that. Before the Constitution. In American law, patents and copyrights are in the Constitution. Trademark came into effect through Consumer Acts and the Lanham Act later than that, but early on in our history. There was a time in kind of the wild, wild west of consumer stuff where God only knows what you were getting. And modern trademark law was in some ways a reaction to lots of people dying from crap they bought that wasn't what they thought it was. Some of the patent medicines that were the just horrible things that people were buying that weren't what they were marketed as, or they were using each other's names, and there was actually a good medicine out there, and someone else would say, hey, that's a clever name, because people have heard of it. I'll slap that name on this bottle that I'm going to fill up out of this bubbling brown creek and call it medicine, woohoo! Which we still do, but at least you have to put the correct name on it. So, older than the Constitution for the most part. But patents and copyrights are in the Constitution and are limited, therefore, in some ways, by the constitutional grants. Trademark is from the Interstate Commerce Clause. Congress is allowed to regulate trade between the states. Trademark is part of that. But it's not expressly in the Constitution. Okay, copyrights is where we're going. I had gotten as far as it sucks for software. It does cover other things well. Copyright is a limited term. Some of you may have heard some of the flutter lately about the extension of the term. Currently, copyright law is the life of the author plus 70 years. Prior to that, it was shorter. Prior to that, it was worse. It has changed over time. The 1976 Copyright Act, which went into effect in 1978, is the act that we currently are under. The copyright law is the 76 Act, which went into effect January 1, 1978. The 76 Act replaced the previous act, which was the 1909 Act, which replaced something before that. I say that only because it affects what is currently in the public domain. Anything which was published before the enactment of the 76 Act, which again was in 78, Anything published prior to that, except there was a little gray area when the 76 Act was being brought into being, when Congress knew they were about to pass it, they passed a few little like grandfathering laws saying, well, anything that comes out this week can go under the new law. It's just not quite here yet. So when I'm trying not to give a specific date of anything published before January 1, 1978, it's not quite that simple, but it's a good rule of thumb. Anything published prior to 1978 comes under the 1909 Act. Under the 1909 Act, you had two short terms. You had to file for renewal in the middle, but after the first term, before the second term, your total there was 56 years. That was then extended with the same extension of the Copyright Act that we have now. When the Copyright Act was passed in 76, it was life plus 50. The Sonny Bono Term Extension Act, which is what recently went to the Supreme Court, was added 20 years to that. It also mucked around with the earlier patent duration, which is why I'm not giving you a specific number and number and number. Anything published prior to 78, it may or may not be in the public domain. You would actually need to sit down with the dates and figure out exactly when which law was passed and when it would have fallen into the public domain. This is one of the reasons that they changed it. Because under the previous act, if you didn't file for your second term, your work went into the public domain and you didn't get the rest of your protection. Lots of authors hated that, especially if they were like magazine article writers or short story writers. If you write some novels, it's probably not that big a deal to remember 19 years later to file your bloody renewal. But if you do lots of things, lots of short stories, something, every week you've got to file another application for renewal. And 98% of works did not go into a second term. That statistic has been used by people to prove two things. One is that obviously no one cared about the second term. No artists actually wanted to bother with the second term because the short term was sufficient for the artists commercially. No one bothered to file the renewals because they didn't care about it. So obviously a short copyright term is all we need. Or you can take that statistic to mean that the renewal system was a god-awful mess and artists couldn't figure out when they were supposed to file their renewals, and lots of people who wanted the protection just couldn't get it because they weren't lawyers and they weren't accountants. And prior, if you recall, back in those days, they did not just have tickler files on their computer calendars to remind them. Plus, it was long enough in the future that, 19 years from now, yeah, sure, I'll remember it, because in 19 years, I'll have my desk cleared off and I'll be much more organized and I'll have some more time.
Okay.
19 years will pass, and you know what? Your desk is still going to be a mess. Your kids presumptively will at least be older, but nevertheless, that free time and great organization that you're certain you will accomplish any minute now isn't going to happen. You will never actually be better at it than you are right now. Stop struggling. It just wastes your time. So when you're trying to figure out what is in the public domain and what is not, it's not a simple question. Prior to the 76 Act, if the work did not have the little C in a circle and then the correct designation following that, it would lose its protection. That's not true anymore. So the presence or absence of the little C in a circle with all rights reserved, a name and a date after it, is not necessary any longer to protect your work. Just because you see something without the little C does not mean it is free for your use. Nevertheless, if you're publishing something yourself, or if you're putting some of your stuff up on the internet or handing it out to your friends or standing on a street corner passing out to people going by, put the little C with a circle and your name and the way to contact you on it. Copyright notices are kind of like the lock on your car. It's not going to keep a thief from taking your car. It's not going to take a pirate from taking your work. But someone who wants to actually be a good person can do so. Oh, I can't use this. See, it's copyrighted. Oh, well, here's the person's contact information. If I want to use it, maybe I can contact them and ask them. So if you want to publish whatever it is you're creating, go ahead and put your name and the copyright notice on it. Put your email. Put some way they can contact you. Not because the law requires it, because it just makes bloody sense. And it will deter some people from using your work without permission if they don't want to break the law. There is a huge belief that is out there that if it is on the internet, I can use it. No. Please don't. that we call that stealing. Now, there are a lot of ways that you can give people rights beyond just giving up all your rights. Many of y'all are familiar with the Creative Commons Project with spearheaded by Lawrence Lessig. This is easy to find on the internet. I assume it's creativecommons.org. Google it comes right up. They have a series of licenses under which you may license your work, which means give away your rights, in varying increments. Copyright gives to you a number of specific rights. The obvious one is the right to copy your work. I wrote this book, and I didn't bring a book with me. I usually have a book to bandy around. Wait, there's some books back here. Ha-ha.
I love his books.
If I wrote this book, which I didn't, but the woman who's here before me did, I own the right to make more copies of it. I own the right to make a sequel to it using, we'll pretend that Secret Codes and Cryptograms is a novel. The characters in Secret Codes and Cryptograms, I have the right to tell the next chapter in their lives. Wind and gone notwithstanding. So I have certain rights with respect to this book. I have the right to, but if I sell this copy of this book, or I give away this copy of the book, the person who now has it, and since I just liberated this, it's mine, I own this copy of this book. I didn't write it, but I own this paper. I can do a lot of things with it. I can rip it up into shreds. I can give it to you. I can sell this copy. There is no law saying I can't sell this copy. I can't turn it into something else. I can't make a derivative work out of it. I can't write the next chapter. If this were art, I couldn't take these pages and mount them on tiles and call it artwork. There are a lot of things I cannot do. The biggest one with books is copy. But I own this physical copy of the book. The author has the right to the words. I have the right to the book. The other thing I have the right to, as the person who just owns this physical copy, is the information inside it. The author owns the expression of her ideas, but she does not own her ideas any longer. This is where it distinguishes from patents. This book is Mystery Codes to be Cracked, okay? I assume she's come up with some brilliant theories about codes embedded in lots of places and secret messages and things like that. She has found some very clever and unique theories, many of which are probably true. Now that she's put them in a book, she no longer owns any of those theories. I could use this book, learn all that she has said, and write my own book with no other research without attributing any of it to her, as long as I do not actually copy the words she used. Her ideas and the facts embedded in this book do not belong to the author, only her expression. Yes?
Hey, what are the copyright issues with using words cited or with quoting from another author in a book?
Okay, the question was about the distinction between quoting another author and citing another author for your work. There are two distinct issues there. One is called plagiarism and one is called copyright infringement. Plagiarism is what you should not do if you're an academic, where if I am an academic, which I am, but not in this area, and I wanted to write a book on this, I bloody well better cite where I got my ideas. Otherwise, it's plagiarism. I'm claiming that I came up with ideas that aren't mine. If my college has any sense, they will kick me out on the street. It's dishonest scholarship, and it's not tolerated in the academic community. Copyright law could care less about that. Copyright law just says, don't copy the damn book. But the facts are expressly not protected. Seminal case in that area with Baker v. Selden, which was a very old case, was by the time it came to trial, both Baker and Selden were dead. But one of them, and honestly, I forget if it's Baker or Selden, was the man who invented the dual entry accounting system. Many of you still use that. He came up with this great way to keep books that was going to work and be much easier for people to use. He wrote a book saying, hey, look, I've got this great accounting system. Come use it. Come buy my book. Except he wasn't very good at going around and finding people and saying, hey, buy my book. He had a great idea. He was a crappy marketer. And apparently his book was kind of dry. Accounting, I don't think it's going to be exciting no matter what. His book was not a commercial success. Along comes, I think it was Selden, might have been Baker. Along comes the other guy who says, my God, that's brilliant. And writes a book on the exact same thing. He didn't have any new ideas. He just said, that'll work. That's brilliant. And wrote a book using all the same things. In fact, he copied the charts from the back of the original work, the worksheets to actually do your accounting entries. He copied those in his book exactly. And the estate of one sued the estate of the other, saying, hey, you can't do that. And the court said, yeah, actually, you can. Because although the original work, the way the accounting method was described, the way that the chapters were divided into different subheadings, those sorts of things are protected. And the language was protected, but it wasn't a verbatim copy. The guy did not copy the language, just the accounting system. The accounting system is not copyrightable. Facts, theories, processes, any of those things are not copyrightable. If they're really clever and you invented them, maybe you can patent them. The dual entry accounting method may actually now be patentable under a business method patent, but at that point those things didn't exist, nor should they now. Going back to the patent system is messed up. But so someone might have been able to patent that accounting method now, but you cannot copyright it. Even the charts, which were copied, were deemed not to be an infringement because in order to use that system, you had to use charts pretty much just like this. So since those charts were integral to using the underlying facts and theories, those charts were not protectable by copyright. If there's too much function in something, it will not be protectable. So the guy who ripped off the original guy got away with it because copyright does not protect the underlying facts or theories or anything else. Just a sec. I want to finish this because it's sort of an answer to a question. So if you get your ideas from someone, yeah, attribute it. Otherwise, you're a creep. But copyright law doesn't care. Copyright law says you don't have to attribute it if it's an idea, but you can't copy the expression. The idea versus expression dichotomy is a big one that lawyers can, lots of lawyers can dance on the head of a pin over that. But the concept is easy. The application is a pain in the butt. But the underlying idea is not protectable. Boy meets girl, bad things happen. Boy and girl lie dead in a cave. Or boy meets girl, bad things happen. They live happily ever after. Those plot lines are not protectable. So Romeo and Juliet, it was fine to do West Side Story because even though it's obviously the same plot line, come on, you're not allowed to own those plot lines. Once you get out further and further into the detail, if you're humming, when you're a jet, okay, now you're infringing. But somewhere before you start humming the tunes, it's just public domain stories and it's okay. Was that sufficient answer to your question?
I had another question.
Well, let me keep going. Well, unless it's like a right follow-up to that.
Yeah, kind of relevant to that. Should you maybe have permission from the author?
Yes. Yes, you should always have permission from an author. That's the short answer. No matter what you're doing, ask bloody permission. The world would be a lot easier and there'd be a lot less lawyers if y'all would just ask each other's permission before you steal each other's stuff. usually, if you are trying to use the author's short quote, like if you're doing a book report, you don't have to get permission to cite a paragraph to critique it. If you're writing a critique for a newspaper of an upcoming work, you can cite short passages of it for the purpose of criticism, because it's fair use, which is what I'm going to talk about later. But short passages quoted for a distinct purpose is fine. But you can't go and take the good stuff out of the book and put them in your review and pretend that you didn't just steal the heart of the book. You're going to get hit with an infringement suit. So, but the easiest thing is just get bloody permission. You have all these folks say, oh, but I have to use this guy's song to express the torment of my soul. Fine. Ask him. And if he says no, write your own damn song and quit calling yourself an artist if you can't compose. But it's not that difficult a concept. But yeah, ask permission, because that's the easiest way to avoid trouble. You would put half of the people in my industry out of business if everyone would just use the common sense approach of, gosh, I'd like to use this. I wonder if I can. And ask. Sometimes they'll say no. And if you're trying to use a work in a way that's commercially advantageous especially, they're probably going to say, well, I'll be happy to sell you a license to that effect. I will give you those rights. But it's going to cost you. Well, if you're in it to make money, so are they. It's not really that unfair. You still don't have a right to steal their stuff just so you can make stuff. If you need their stuff to make your stuff, perhaps you should have come up with your own original stuff in the first place. But if you're using it for purposes of criticism or something like that, you do have a narrow outline. Let me get a little bit of a kind of overview of what the rights are from copyrights before I go back into questions, because I'll get into your questions and never actually get back to the basics I'm supposed to cover. So copyright, the right to copy is the obvious one. You also are given with your copyright a lot of other rights. The right to make copies, the right to make derivative works, which is the movie rights from your novel, the translation of your novel into other languages, the answer book to the quizzes you had in your textbook, things like that. Those are all derivative works. Something based on the original. It's the choreography of the poetry, whatever. It's the creative work in another form or the follow-up to it. Those are all also rights reserved to the author, as is the performance right and a number of others that are strange. So, you have, as the copyright holder, a lot of rights. You can give them away, and I'm holding my hands like this because the phrase that we keep using in law is bundle of sticks. The bundle of rights is like a bundle of sticks, and it's a stupid analogy, but I keep not coming up with a better one, so I'm going to use it anyway. I hold in my hands a bundle of sticks. I can give each of you one stick. Each of you has some portion of my rights. I don't have to give all the rights away to my copyright. I can say, well, okay, you can have the right to the screenplay once the check clears. You can have the right to set it to music. You can have the right to make it into artwork. I can give away any of a number of rights. They can be exclusive, they can be eternal. There are lots and lots of different ways I can determine who can use it for what. And I can partition those rights into as little bitty twigs and splinters as I can figure out how to do, and I have people who are willing to pay for it. So you have all of those rights, and the way in which you convey them is called a license. Many of you are familiar with licenses because although you used to own these, if you go and get them now from Amazon on Kindle, you no longer own it. You are licensing it. You are, in effect, renting the book if you don't own a tangible copy of it. Just like all of the software that you have, you do not own. You have licensed it from Bill Gates, and when you clicked I agree, you probably should have read it, because there's some really good stuff in there. I don't know if y'all remember the old Dilbert comics about I just agreed to be Bill Gates' towel boy. It's in there, actually. And I kid you not, in many of these standard Microsoft EULAs, end user license agreements, there is a clause for Microsoft not being liable if this somehow causes nuclear war. I have it in the footnote of my last article because, honest to God, it was there. I'm like, no, you're kidding, right? But I just wanted a word processor. I got really worried about the footnote process. I was afraid maybe it was embedded in there somewhere. But yes, when you license software, you do not own it. You own the disk if it came on a disk, but when you download it, you don't own squat. And you do not have this right that I was saying that I had with this, the right to loan it to my friends, the right to give it away, the right to sell it. First sale doctrine. Once this tangible book is sold, I have rights to this tangible copy. Well, I'm not buying a tangible anything from Microsoft. I'm getting the licensed right to use the code that they are implanting in my computer. And my rights are defined by that thing that I clicked I agreed to. Everything that was there, I agreed to, and that is binding under law. It doesn't matter that you didn't read it. It doesn't matter that it's really, really unfair. Too bad. The courts have deemed that to be a legal contract. You are bound by everything you agreed to when you clicked I agree. The main thing you agreed to was, I'm getting nothing from you except the hope that this is going to work properly. And if you try to use it in a way that they don't approve of, they can do all sorts of awful things to you, which you're mostly aware of, such as shutting down your entire operating system because you didn't renew your Netscape license. But regardless, so the copyright license is a powerful, powerful tool, and it is in many ways supplanting the traditional sale of goods. But that's where the Creative Commons license comes in, because people often say, well, I would like to be able to share my work. Software people do this especially. However, software people do not use the Creative Commons license. Any software folks in here? Do not use the Creative Commons license on your software. It says it on the website several times over. Do not use the Creative Commons license on your software. Go look at the GNU licensor, the free software folks. There are plenty of them out there that are good. I like the GNU one. But Creative Commons is for traditional copyright stuff. Art, music, things like that, books, things like that. And it is intended for those. The Creative Commons folks are actually really good. I find them neat because it's kind of like a chaotic approach to law. This doesn't usually happen. But Lessig and his people have come up with a very neat system which is getting really widespread popularity, whereby you can say, okay, I've created this work, I would like people to be able to use it, but I want them to to give me attribution. I want to give them credit if they use it from me. And as long as they're using it for a non-commercial use, then they don't have to ask my permission. They can just use it. In fact, if you're trying to get people to buy your songs or read your book, saying, sure, use my stuff, go ahead, is becoming a somewhat successful marketing technique. Put it out there for free and people will start to buy it. It sounds counterintuitive. A number of publishers are having success with it. Bain Publishers are doing that with Real Honest to God books, and they are selling copies because they put them out for free. If you are a struggling artist trying to get notice, the fact that you're trying to sell your work and no one is buying it, you will not be any worse off if some people start getting it for free because you still have no money. But the people who get it for free might share it with their friends, and some of their friends might have enough money to then buy it from you. You will start getting at least some buzz and some following. That's the theory. And in some cases, it does work. Creative Commons license is a great way to do that so that you don't have to give away all of your rights, but you can give away as many of them as you want in a very easy, user-friendly, you don't have to be a lawyer because they are sort of way. I recommend the Creative Commons because unlike pretty much anything else you can download on the internet, these agreements are very good. For the most part, if you can find an agreement to use on the internet, don't. They suck. Anything you can download on the internet for free or even for a fee that is a legal agreement, no. The GNU agreements, the free software guys have some different ones, as I recall. Those are good. Most of the other stuff out there is just crap. You'd be better off using nothing. There's a reason lawyers are expensive. It's because drafting agreements is hard, and the stuff that's up there is not good. Even wills and stuff, guys, if you actually have things that you care about who gets them, go to a lawyer. Don't use something you downloaded off the internet. NOLO law is cute and all, and there is some okay stuff on there, but if it's something that's important to you, don't download it off the internet. Because even if you pay for some of them, I just out of curiosity downloaded a couple forms when I was doing a project. And I was like, well, let me see if I pay the $20 for this form, what I get. Oh my God, it was just awful. It would have in no way advanced what I wanted to do, and it would have actually set me back. So bad agreements often worse than no agreement. So either get a lawyer to write it for you. The Creative Commons licenses are great. The GNU stuff and the free software guys have good ones also. There's another one whose name's escaping me. They're not a big software guru here. But those are good. Most of them just stink, and you will be worse off. Even will in a box that you get from Office Depot, if it really matters, pay the $500 and get a lawyer to go over it with you. Wills and accounting are two things where you really don't want to go for the cheap way out, because if it's wrong, it's too late to fix it. Kind of like surgery. You don't want to go to the discount surgeon. You don't want to do a do-it-yourself cataract surgery. You really don't want to do a do-it-yourself legal process either, for kind of the same reasons, because you'll end up bleeding and unhappy. Okay, there were some questions that I kind of put off, but I want to get through that basic thing. Yeah.
I was wondering, if an artist sells a work to a buyer and has the buyer sign a artist purchasing agreement which stipulates what the buyer can do as far as destruction, damage, selling it, modifying it, how enforceable are those artist buyer agreements?
It depends, which is a great legal answer. Because the law tells us that if you sell your physical copy, then that physical copy belongs to the person who purchased it. So you as an author have no further rights over that tangible copy. However, if you agreed with the seller that they do not have rights to it, first off, you should call it a license. Anything you pretty much agree to in a contract is enforceable under the contract, though. If you had to enforce it against them, you would be enforcing it as a breach of contract, not as a copyright violation. Because copyright gives you no protection once you sell it, but contract does. That's why copyright licensing, that's why the software companies license you stuff rather than sell you stuff, because if they sold it to you, they would be bound by the copyright law, which terminates at first sale. However, if they license it to you, you're stuck with whatever stupid terms you agree to. So if, in effect, you are licensing the work, then whatever adhesive terms you come up with are, for the most part, enforceable at law under the contract, not under copyright. Yeah?
Related to that, so if I buy a painting, if I buy the original painting, I can't print it and sell it to my friend?
Absolutely not. You own the tangible copy. You do not... Well, I mean, intuitively you knew that when you bought this book, you weren't allowed to make copies of it and sell it to your friends.
I think that's true. And I didn't have the original.
Doesn't matter. You, if you purchase something that is a copyrighted work, you own that tangible copy. You can destroy it. You can give it away. You can sell it. You cannot copy it. And you cannot transform it into something else. That's a derivative work, and the adaptation right belongs to the author unless you have purchased that right. That's that kind of bundle of sticks things again. But the first sale doctrine is important. The first sale doctrine is what is being completely hijacked by licensing agreements. And as they try to make books into bundles of software instead of books, you'll lose your first sale right on books as well. If there's no tangible thing that you purchased, you have no first sale right. Yeah?
I was wondering, I'm an artist and I create characters for my comics. If I were to do a different design and I haven't been working on the comic for a while and I didn't design it, do I have to do it with a copyright on some of the copyrights that I currently own?
It depends on that. If you're really doing a new work, oh, I'm sorry. She asked if she's working on a comic book and she lets it sit for a while and she comes back and kind of redoes it and moves forward with it, does she have to refile her copyright? I didn't actually even talk about filing copyrights. Let me get to that. Your copyright attaches when you create the work, when it is fixed in a tangible medium, when you write it down. When it's in your head, no protection. Once you finish the work and it's fixed in a tangible medium, whether it's paint, computer counts as fixed and tangible medium. Once it is written down, painted, sculpted, whatever, created, copyright protection attaches at that moment. Previous rules, you may have heard about publication being when your rights attach. That's the 09 Act, not the current act. So old law was rights attach to publication. Now they attach at moment of creation, at moment fixation. So when the work is fixed, you own the copyright. It is better for you to file a copyright claim with the Library of Congress and get your copyright officially registered. You get greater rights that way, and a lot of them are kind of esoteric litigation rights, but it is better practice to go ahead and do that. You can certainly do copyright filing. They're very simple. It's very little. It's little more than your name, the name of the work, and a copy of the work. If it's a big sculpture, it tells you what to do, and they don't really want you to send them the sculpture. This was created basically by the Library of Congress as a great way for them to own all of the books. You have to give them one if you want a copyright. But it made sense at the beginning. Still does to an extent. So you have all of those rights, but you get greater rights. So go ahead and file the copyright. To the extent that you're worried about your earlier version being copyrighted and your later version being copyrighted, when you get done, file a copyright claim. Because you have protection already just by creating it. And you can make yourself sick trying to file a new copyright claim every time you revise it a little bit. Wait till you're done, then file a copyright claim is the better practice. Yeah?
All right. I was making a long series that essentially is cemented as what it's supposed to be. Going back and make changes. But it's a long series, and I have to normalize every the character of things and designs and everything like that. What is the proper time for copyright, and what exactly do I send for my favorite artists to do that? Do I send, like,
Okay, the question was when he files based on a very long series, as in novels?
Well, like his, I'm doing a graphic novel.
Okay, graphic novel series. He has it all planned out. When does he copyright it? All of your planning out, that's still ideas for a novel. Your notes are copyrightable if you've written them down, but the notes are not the same as the book that you will write. So you can copyright the book when you have written the book. So I would copyright each volume as it comes out. Copywriting your notes, the Library of Congress really doesn't want a copy of your notes. You can file it, and if you go through the filing form, there are just instructions on there as to what physical copy they want or don't want. The deposit requirement is in there, deposit being deposit of the work, not money deposit, like it sounds like. So the instructions are there online, and it varies greatly with what the work is. So look there, and the instructions are easy to follow. There are also people who can help you with this at all of these places. I know that most of y'all used to online help, but the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office and the Library of Congress copyright folks, there are actual people on the other end of the phone who will answer your questions if you have a specific one, and they're good at it. The trademark folks are very helpful if you ask nicely. They get treated badly a lot. Call them and say, I'm trying to do this, but have a specific question. I'm trying to attach a specimen and I'm confused. They will help you with that. I don't get this. This system sucks. I can't even do this. You're not going to get a good answer. Same with the specific question for what, if anything, you need to deposit the Library of Congress. When you have something tangible, ask them, do I send this, do I not? And they will tell you. But it's a seemingly simple question, but I don't want to give you the wrong answer, not knowing exactly what it is you're creating. So it's not, so, you know, your copyright attaches when you create, when you fix, but do your filing when you have something to file. There.
You brought up the second question, but I have a first one. Names, proper names that you create in your book, not like Catherine, but like Lee Pace, mm-hmm. Are those copyrighted?
Okay, he asked whether names of your characters can be copyrightable. The book itself, together with the names and the characters themselves, can be copyrighted if they are sufficiently fleshed out, unique characters. If you've got an Irish cop who's got red hair, a little heavy set, and a slight drinking problem named O'Malley, none of that is protectable. If you have a evil guy who almost took over the wizard world and was killed and has a snake as his symbol, and no one will speak his name, but it starts with a V, you're getting into something that would be protectable. There is a lot in between, but you cannot just copyright a character. You copyright the book in which the character occurs, and the character, along with the plot and all of that, gets the protection, frankly, it deserves. Voldemort gets some protection. O'Malley, the drinking Irish cop, not so much. If he likes potatoes, it makes it even worse. Yeah?
What about international copyright, like old, you know, old stuff, like Dostoevsky or Tolkien?
It depends, again. International copyright law is basically a big morass that I can't answer a short question. We currently are signatories to the Berne Convention, which means all foreign authors get the same rights that American authors get in this country, and we get the same rights in other countries that we would get were we domiciled there. So now we're kind of a member of the world community. Dostoevsky, good God, that was long enough ago. That's in public domain. Tolkien's estate can hold on to those for a long time. So I don't honestly off the top of my head if Tolkien stuff is in public domain yet or not. Basically, if it was someone who died 300 years ago, it's not protected anymore. If it was someone who's still alive knew, it may well still be copyrighted. And the laws changed, and back then it was very easy for works to lose their copyright based on failure of notice or failure of renewal or all those things that I mentioned before. So Tolkien, I don't know, Dostoevsky, wasn't he like 1800s? Yeah, you can use that. But if you use a particular translation of that, since Dostoevsky did not write in English, the translation may well still be copyrighted. Now, if a translation is a derivative work, if you do a translation of an old work, your translation is a derivative work and it is copyrightable. However, all that is copyrightable is what you have added to the work. So to the extent there's some elegance to how you translate rather than just verbatim in the order that the words came in Russian, and please don't do that, no one will ever be able to understand it. To the extent you've added something creative and unique as you did the translation, those elements belong to you, so someone cannot just verbatim copy your translation. However, you get no rights to the Dostoevsky. So it's only what you add that you get the copyright in. And that gets to be kind of an angel's dance on the head of the pin too. Well, I chose to express what he said in this way. Well, yeah, but in Russian it said he was hungry, so he ate some soup. You said he needed food, so he ate some soup. You don't get to own the sentence as a result, if that makes any sense. Okay. Yeah?
You were making reference earlier about not going to the internet. What about, legal things that's supposed to be from lawyers?
Anything you can download off the internet that is a legal agreement stinks, with a very few exceptions. Creative Commons, the Genia guys are very good. Some of the stuff on LegalZoom and Nolo and those places, some of them are kind of adequate. None of them are good. If it was good, they wouldn't be giving it away to you. And the problem is none of you can tell the difference. I don't mean that in quite as patronizing way as it sounds, but okay, I do really. I can't tell the difference between good and bad software until I use it and say this doesn't work, but usually that's also user error. But you can't tell if the contract's any good or not. And most of them, the vast majority of them, stink. Like I said, I went and downloaded some that I had to pay a little bit of money for just to see what was out there. And most of them really, really are bad. So for the most part, I wouldn't risk it. I'd go actually hire a lawyer. And I've had to hire lawyers because they do things that I don't do. We're very specialized. And I have had to pay money to lawyers to do things for me. And I hated it too, but it got done correctly.
It's just the sale of, oh, I created this. I didn't know how legit it was.
Oh, if you're trying to do it for copyright protection, use the Creative Commons stuff. It's much better. In the back.
When you're creating an original work and it's based off previous existing work, let's say a good example is like the Gunnam artist album. There's all these amazing interpretations of characters that are popular, like, say superheroes or things like that. How distinct do you have to make it so that it's not considered derivative of an original creation?
If the question is about artwork that you may see, like an artist alley, if they've created artwork based on characters out of books, chances are all of those, if you look at it and know who the character is, are infringing. That's a derivative work. I wrote a novel and you drew a picture of one of the guys in my novel. That's a derivative work. That's an infringement of my copyright. A lot of authors, especially the smart ones, don't mind that because it means someone's excited enough about their work that they want to go draw pictures of it. As long as they were not intending to draw and sell pictures of it, they're like, cool, go for it. Fan fiction and fan art and all the fan-generated works are infringement. They are illegal infringement. Most authors like them because it means I've got fans who are so jazzed about my stuff that when I bring out my next novel, they're going to buy it. They're going to get in a room together at Dragon Con and talk about me. They may invite me to come there. I'll get to go in the green room. They've got good food there. You know, there are lots of artists who think that'd be great. At some point, you cross a line. The Rowling examples are good. She let the kids do all of their fan stuff and everything else until one particular kid went too far and created the Encyclopedia of Hogwarts, which, let's be real, it doesn't stretch the imagination too far. I think J.K. Rowling will, in fact, want to publish one of those when she's tired of her multi-gazillion dollars and wants a few more. She may want to publish that. Well, here's some kid doing it. You know, he doesn't get to do that. Dress up as Hagrid, that's fine. Draw pictures, put them on your Facebook page. Yeah, go nuts. But when you cross a line, they may stop you. And the reality is, all of that fan stuff is infringement. It is illegal, unless you have permission, which gets us back to the lesson at the beginning of this show, which was ask.
Unless it's Disney, you never want to do Disney.
Disney will come and kill you. Don't mess with the mouse. Yeah.
In a prior year at DragonCon, I heard a writer talking about a legal battle she was getting over her name. She was using a pen name or a pseudonym when she first started writing, and the publishing company she originally used said they owned rights to that name since it wasn't her actual name.
She should have talked to a lawyer before she signed her publishing agreement. The question was about an author who was apparently embattled over a legal issue of whether or not she owned her pen name or whether her first publisher did. Authors who sign their first publishing deal usually do not have lawyers because their first publishing deal, they haven't quit their day jobs yet. They don't have any money. So she probably did not hire a lawyer to read over the first publishing agreement. And oh my God, publishing agreements are almost as bad as license agreements. Wow, they will ask for everything. It would not surprise me if they owned her name. It would not surprise me if they owned her children. but it just, so again, don't download internets off or agreements off the internet. But if you sign one, read it. And don't believe what the secretary tells you it means. I was actually talking with an online university that I misguidedly almost taught for, and they sent me the, okay, now that we've hired you, we love you, we want you, we want you, here's the work made for hire agreement. And I said, no, this is academics, we don't do that. Work made for hire agreement is what you sign for your company, proving that any thought you have belongs to them, not yourself. It's generally the default case anyway. If you are employed, your employer owns anything you create that's related to your job. There are technicalities along the way for that. But the work made for hire agreement is the extra step they often take to make sure, and if it's not a traditional employment agreement, it protects the employer further. Well, this agreement said they own everything that I may write during the term of my employment. I'm like, no, I'm picking up a little extra money from you teaching some online crap. You don't own everything I write. And the HR woman, who was trying to get it signed so it would complete the file, assured me that that's not what it meant. I'm like, okay, I draft these for a living. Oh, well, I'm sure it doesn't mean that. I'm like, that's really cute. Can you give me a lawyer I can talk to? The general counsel of this particular online university assured me it didn't mean that. He's like, well, just write a good exclusion and you can keep whatever it is you need to keep. And I'm like, dude, there's no room for an exclusion in this agreement. Sure there is. The general counsel had not actually read their current agreement. The HR chick was just stupid and lying, both, I believe, and the general counsel had not read his own agreement. Read it yourself. If you don't understand some of the words, don't ask them, ask your own lawyer, because they will tell you things like, oh no, it doesn't mean that.
And if you work for IBM and you sign that, then they have the same clause in there.
You can sign away your rights to everything, not just the stuff related to your job. So a work made for hire agreement does not just immortalize and, you know, confirm the law as it stands, which is things you do in the scope of employment that are the sort of thing that would benefit your employer, scope of employment, time of employment, to further your employer's interests. Those normally will belong to your employer. If you sign an agreement, you can sign much more than that. Read it. If you're not certain, get a lawyer to read it. Usually, if you go to, I mean, if it's a big company, if you go to the, if you can get to a counsel's office in the big company, they will seldom look you in the eye and lie to you. The HR people often don't know. Oh, I'm sure it doesn't mean that. We, and here's one, do not ever fall for, oh yes, but we never enforce that. They tried that on me. I'm like, good God, I teach at a law school. I teach my kids not to believe that crap. You're insulting me at this point. I literally told one of them, like, perhaps you should read my CV and then we can have this conversation. And after they read my CV, they no longer tried that bullshit on me. But y'all can't show 10 years of legal experience, so read the agreements and have a lawyer who can't lie to you answer it for you. Yeah?
I just wanted to comment on the Creative Commons.
Uh-huh. Use them. They're great.
One thing about them is they specialize in Ben and GNU, they specialize in, their licenses are about sharing your work to as many people. If you want to reserve all rights and sell every right specifically, you probably don't want to use one of their licenses. I mean, the basic idea of Creative Commons is a license which allows you to share your work and allow other people to share your work, but you still retain some rights. So depending on what rights you want to keep, you may not want
The Creative Commons license has a lot of different variations of it. If you go through their website, they have a little summary of this license gives away these rights and keeps these rights. This license gives away these rights and keeps these rights. They have a whole slew of them. If there's not one you like, don't use one.
Yeah,
but they have a lot of variations and levels of protection.
They also have, going back to the international thing, you have to go and you say what rights you want, and then you generate a license per country. They spent the last year going through having lawyers from almost every country in the world make the license work for all the legal system in the individual countries. So it's actually not just one license you get. You get hundreds of licenses.
I don't know the details for each country's laws because I'm not that good. I can't speak directly to the value of Creative Commons international licenses. Their basic product is very good, so I would tend to trust it for the international, but I can't tell you specifically because that's beyond what I know, so I can't look at that and tell you if it's good or not. Yeah?
On a flip side to the works made for hire, if you hire somebody to do something for you, a lot of times people are just surprised as to be that the person you hired actually owns the copyright, unless you have an agreement that specifically deals with, like, you get somebody to design your web page or do a photograph for a book or draw a drawing for a book,
if you have hired someone to do something for you, you have made a work for hire. If you are hiring someone to make a work for you, you may or may not own it, they may or may not own it. It depends on the nature of the work. If this person is not your full-time employee and you do not have an agreement with them saying that you own it, there is no chance that you own it. They own it. If you are an artist who works on a contract basis for people, or if you are the sort of person who hires artists or any creative folks to do things for you on a contract basis, between the two of you, you must agree who owns what and what rights go where and put it in a signed agreement. Both of you must sign it. Make that signed agreement before the work is done, before the money's due. Figure out in advance, okay, I want you to make this logo for my company. Now, does that mean the artist can continue to use that logo and sell it to other people? Well, if you don't say not to, they probably can. Would they? One would hope not. But get it in writing, figure out what you want to own, figure out what they want to own, and a lot of artists will give you all of the rights to it, it just costs more. It's up to you whether you think that's worth it or not, but make sure you know what you're buying and what you're not.
How do you file a copyright?
Go on to the Library of Congress website. And LOC.gov, I think. Don't write that down at pen. Library of Congress, copyright file. It's there somewhere. It's easy to find and easy to do.
If I own some IP and I wanted to send an IP a podcast,
okay,
how would I prevent you from stealing it because I'm talking about it?
If you want to own a copyright in something you are broadcasting or say it, you must record it. Because remember, your copyright attaches when it is fixed in a tangible media. I assume that I'm being recorded back there, which means that this is copyrighted. If I were not, then only my notes would be copyrighted, and yeah. So that would be, I have no rights to this particular speech, as it is, since they are fixing a tangible medium for me, I own the copyright value of this speech.
Woo!
Yeah, okay. I'm sure people will be beating a trail to my door to give me money for that. But regardless, so record it, then it's fixed to keep them from stealing. Oh, good luck. Once it's out there, people will steal it if they want to. There are again, there's two theories. One is try to encrypt it and try to keep them from getting it, and that ain't gonna work. It's like car locks and car alarms. It will keep some people from doing it. If you encrypt it even remotely, I can't steal it from you, but I can't hear it either, most likely. So if you want to share your work out there so people can see it and hear it, that means they can also steal it. I drive my car here, which means someone can probably steal it. I left my house where it is. Someone can go into it and steal stuff too. I have a lock on my door. I have an alarm. I have a dog. I have guns. So hopefully people won't break in and steal stuff from me, but I can only hope that. On the internet, it's even easier to steal. So I can continue to hope that they won't steal from me there, but they probably will. So put your name all over it, and hope for the best. Alternately, you can try a few technical ways to protect it, but again, the more you protect it from being stolen, the more you're protecting it from your audience. Yeah? In the back, black shirt.
How do you personally use specifically electronic or print? If I buy a book, a print copy, if I'm taking my laptop somewhere, can I essentially scan the book and put it in and take that copy with me?
You can do that for sound recordings. I honestly don't know if you're allowed to do it on books. I believe not. There is a specific... the question was whether if he buys a book, a real one, if he buys a book, can he scan a copy of that for personal use on his computer? I believe the answer is no, but there is an exception if you own... Back in the days when we actually owned records, there was an exemption. There was an exception saying you can make a tape of your record to listen to in your car. You're allowed to make backups of some things on your computer for merely backup and archival purposes, not to then use on a different computer. So, honestly, I don't know for certain. I believe the answer is no.
What about the reverse? You have an electronic book and you're going, I don't know, camping, and you print it off.
That depends completely on the license agreement that you clicked I agree on. That's not a matter of copyright any longer because you agreed to all kinds of stuff. The answer is probably no, you're not allowed to. The answer is probably you can only read it once and then you have to sell, you have to destroy it or pay them more money. It depends on the term of the license agreement. Yeah. Oh wait, I'm sorry, in the back. Yes, you. Yes. For derivative use, she asked about an exception for a parody. That gets into fair use. In theory, if you are doing literary criticism or a parody or for educational purposes or other similar uses, you may use a copyrighted work for those purposes. The use is deemed a fair use. That is not, by the way, an absolute right. That is a defense to an infringement suit. So you know you're in trouble already if you have to claim fair use. it is better to do what?
Ask.
Yes, ask permission. That would be better. If you are relying on fair use, you've already heard from a lawyer, so your day is bad. But in theory, yes, parody is an expressly allowed use under fair use rights. And that one has been expanded recently to ridiculous levels because of a couple very, well, one particular very smart good lawyer here in Atlanta who has created some really bad law by being a very good lawyer. But so the parody right has expanded stupidly. The educational right, however, is, this is why I'm trying to give you the don't just assume that rules, because parody now applies to things that are not parodies, but educational use, even though in the statute it says copies made for use in a classroom are allowed under fair use. If I make copies of someone's work to hand out in my classroom, I will be sued and I will lose. The statute says I can do it, the law says I cannot. Because it used to be, if you were just going to excerpt an article or one chapter from a book, you never knew who the publishers were, it was very hard to get a hold of them, and everything took so long you could never do it. Well, now there's only two publishers left in the world. You can get permission or get turned down, and all of them have sliding scales for how much it costs you to use works for the classroom, so you don't get to do it free anymore, even though, God help us, it says we can in the text, in the text of the law. So don't rely on fair use, because fair use is something litigators create to suit their individual cases. If you need to use something and you're using it beyond just in your home for your own self, meaning someone might care, you should get permission if you can. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm running out of time. Am I out or are we close? What?
We got 10 minutes.
10 minutes, okay. Yes.
I think you said earlier the term of copyright is the life of the author for 70 years.
Yes.
Is that the same if you're posing your own name as well as if you're posing your pseudonym? Or
pseudonym is different. Pseudonym is 90 years from publication, I think. Because it's either 90 or 125, I think it's 90 years from publication. Just like a copyright owned by a corporation is also a term from the publication. Remember I told you publication used to matter? It still does if you use a fake name or if you're a corporation, because corporations don't die, and fake names, it's kind of hard to look up the death records on them too. So it's triggered from the publication date forward. Yeah. When you register your pseudonym, when you file the copyright application, your name is on there, and if you have a pen name, it's on there also.
Yep.
So there was another note. Yeah.
Karaoke CD use. Karaoke music, all this kind of stuff.
Uh huh. Must.
Many times, if you want to follow the instructions and get permission, contacting a manufacturer of a karaoke CDG is very difficult because they're usually in Asia and they don't even have permission to use the music that they're using.
Well, if they don't, the question is about using works on karaoke. If the people from whom you're buying the machine and the disc don't have the rights to use it, then neither do you. To buy an actual licensed version, I'm not a karaoke kind of person, but I assume that the ones that are used in the bar up here at night, that those are ASCAP licensed and money goes to the people they're supposed to go to. The music industry has a whole lot of compulsory licenses and money goes to, every time a song is played on the radio, money goes to a couple of people, but usually not the singers. And so the radios pay into a fund. The fund is distributed out of ASCAP and some other organizations like that to the people they're supposed to distribute it to. Karaoke, being a public performance of those songs, should be covered by a similar thing. If it's being done in public, you need, if you're doing it at home, I mean, ASCAP's not going to come knocking on your door and get you in trouble for having six kids singing karaoke in your living room. If you're doing it public, make sure you've got a licensed version and the license fees are being paid where they ought to be paid.
The permissions on some of these CDGs actually say not legal unless played at full volume. So that kind of gives you the impression they're not even serious about their own license.
I have not looked at karaoke licenses, but if you're doing it in your living room, no one's going to catch and no one's going to care. If you're doing it in public, make sure you have a legitimate license for that use. Because ASCAP sends people to Dragon Con. They send people to restaurants. They will find you. Yes. I'm sorry, the woman behind you.
What is the average cost of a copyright filing, though?
It's was it $35, $45? It's not. There's not an average fee. It's what the Lagerfeuer charges. It's minimal. It's less than $100. I think it's $45. It might be $35. It's a minimal charge. Now, if you hire a lawyer to do it, it's a lot more. Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts on Google and its indexing efforts? And isn't there recently a mass action lawsuit that says they get the right to sell books and get publishers a fee?
Well, at one point, one of them, it may have been Google, wanted to scan all of the books in the world in spite of the author's arguments that they weren't allowed to, and they can't do that.
It was Google.
Yeah, Google wanted to create Google Library, and they're just going to take everyone's work whether they were allowed to or not. And yeah, you can't do that. That violates copyright law. Even if you're Google, copyright law applies.
There's a website where you're not
in. Isn't there currently a mass action lawsuit in progress? I think it's from Google. Saying they have the right, they're going to try to have the right to sell any book, and then they will then in turn give the fees to the publisher.
I haven't heard of such a suit, but you can't take someone's rights away just because you're big. It seems like they can do a lot of things. If they were to sign agreements with the publishers, then sure, but they cannot force authors to give up their rights to sell their own works.
You know, class action lawsuit?
That just means that there's some very rich lawyers at the end of the day. It doesn't mean that the law changes.
Yeah, I thought it was fixed.
Yeah.
Can you copyright a website, and should you?
You certainly can. A website is fixed and tangible medium for purposes of the law. You have, assuming you have put some creative effort into it, and it can be a modicum, and it doesn't have to be good. Copyright judges are not art critics. It can stink and still be copyrighted. It doesn't have to be good. It does not have to be clever. Patents have to have a level of novelty and unique art. Copyrights, just a little bit of creativity, a modicum of human effort thrown in there somewhere is sufficient. So assuming you did something to your website that's at least remotely unique, unique is not the right word. It's the right word for English, but not for lawyers. As long as there's something marginally creative about it, not just your name and phone number and website address, in black type on a white screen, then yes, it's copyrighted. Whether you should or not, you can. If there's some particular reason you feel the need to actually get the extra layer of protection of copyright for your website.
We want the material on it to be copyrighted.
Well, you don't have to do it through the website then. Just rather than trying to copyright the website, copyright the material. The website's just where you're displaying it.
Is a website a tangible?
It counts as fixed, yes. If you have written something and posted it on your website, frankly, it was copyrighted when you wrote it or drew it or whatever. Posting it to your website is irrelevant. It just makes it easier for people to see. But that counts as fixed and tangible medium. It is subject to copyright and is protected once it's there, even before it's there. If you want to actually make a copyright filing on that, I would just go ahead and file the copyright for the works that you're concerned with, not just, the website's just like the wall if you hung your painting up over there. Web is not anything in particular. It's just where you're putting your stuff.
That's what I'm trying to figure out, if that's tangible or
it counts as tangible medium for purposes of copyright law. It is not a tangible medium by purposes of how the English language actually works. It is tangible medium for purposes of copyright law. So it is fixed if it is on your computer. But posting on the website just means you put it out where people can see it. That doesn't change your copyright. It changes your likelihood to have it stolen from you, but it does not change your legal status with respect to your copyright, if that makes any sense.
How would you register if you're updating daily or hourly?
You'd have to file each thing you registered. So again, the good news is copyright attaches at the moment of fixation. You don't have to register each one of those. If you really have good stuff on there you care about, well, okay, every month, every year, every whatever, register the new stuff that's on there if you want. But technically, your rights attach when it's fixed. You don't have to register with the Library of Congress to be protected. So you do something reasonable if you do want to have the official copy with the Library of Congress, which does give you greater rights, and a lot of them involve litigation, and you can do it after the fact. If you know you're about to be in a lawsuit, you go ahead and file the copyright notice at that point. It is better to do so for a number of litigation reasons, and it's just always better to go through the official, there I filed, I have a record of when I filed, that increases my ability to say, see, on that day I'd already written it. So do that. Oh, many of you have heard the put it in an envelope and mail it to yourself thing? Yeah, no. That does you no good whatsoever. Don't waste your time doing that. It's kind of, apparently they used to tell you to put butter on burns. Don't do that either. You hear a lot of stuff that just isn't true. Mailing it to yourself has no legal value. But if you want to protect it, go ahead and mail a copy to the Library of Congress with your copyright application. That has legal value. Yeah?
I've always heard that you don't actually need to register unless you're going to sue someone or take legal action. And there's a couple other use cases other than that.
That's sort of true. Like I said, most of the rights that you get with your copyright filing do relate to litigation. And you can file just before you can file the registration just before you file the lawsuit. But it's better practice if you have a real work that you actually care about, go ahead and file the application. It's not hard and it's not expensive. Don't feel the obligation to update your blog every hour with Library of Congress. They will call you and tell you to stop after a certain point. But you know, if you have a book or a work that's somewhat complete or a year's worth of My Brilliant Blog that you do want to go ahead and get the official filing on, go ahead and do it. It's good practice. And again, it does, if nothing else, serve as an easy, before we get to trial where no one can afford to be, way of proving someone else, see you more on, I did too write this first.
Is there any, are there any non-litigation based benefits to it of note?
It does give you, like I said, it gives you an easier way to prove that you owned it and you have a copy there on file with them. So it gives some precedential value. That's the actual way to do the mailing something to yourself in an envelope. Yes?
Where there are so many comics or bands or books that may have the same title or name, mm-hmm. Is it more the content that...
Well, remember that the source of goods is protected under trademark. So a band name is identifying their services or their music. So the band name itself is generally not copyrightable. The band name would be trademarkable, should they want to do so. You can have, depending on the band and depending on the companies, sometimes more than one company has rights to something. It's a more complicated thing. There are plenty of books with the same title. There will continue to be plenty of books with the same title. Because remember, copyright applies to the work, not just a couple of words.
More of the art style, more content.
The whole work. You can't copyright a couple of words of your novel. So if you want to own the title to your series of books, if you want to own your book title and keep anyone else from using that to identify a similar kind of book, you can do so through trademark, not through copyright. Copyright's going to only, it says as a matter of law, you cannot copyright company names or just slogans or logos. That's trademark, not copyright. Copyright's got to be a work, not a couple pieces of word. Unless it's some big modern art thing, which is the written on the side of the wall somewhere. But you're not copywriting the word the, you're copywriting your brilliant idea to paint it on a wall and call it art. Or your impressive marketing ability to get people to pay you for that being art.
I was also wondering then, is it bad grammar per se to put a copyright symbol at the end of a name of a comic strip?
I'd slap the slogan, I would slap the thing on there just to encourage people not to steal it. It has some deterrent effect. And if nothing else, it gets your name on there with this, something that everyone understands what it means. And so if they want to contact you, they will know who to contact. It does not really have any legal effect anymore. It used to be if you failed to use that mark when you needed to, you lost your copyright. But now you don't have to use it at all. It's better to use it. And if you want people to know who to contact, it's a great way to do it because everyone still knows what that little mark means. Oh, this is the guy who owns the copyright. And now that I see it, Now, that means I can't use it. There are plenty of people who believe if it's on the web without a copyright mark, they can use it freely. They are wrong, but they're wrong and taking your stuff. Yeah.
Sorry, I hope this isn't a repeat question, but is trademark still, is that still $300?
$325.
Okay, thank you.
Speaking of trademark, the copyright symbol, is it true that you can use the TM on anything, but R is just eventually registered?
Yes. It's that or the flip, but that's correct. Yeah, TM is if you're using it, that's your state mark, and R is registered trademark. Okay. Yeah. When you can and cannot use that in particular, and when you should use the SM versus the TM or the R is on one of the FAQs on the on the website. There are a lot of very good FAQs and a lot of good information on the USPTO website. It's remarkably well done. They've been changing it. They've been updating it because God knows they needed to. For quite some time, when they first changed over to all electronic filing, you could only file your trademark electronically. And one of the parts of a trademark filing is a specimen that's an example of how it's used. and they gave you the dimensions of the piece of paper that you had to fit the picture on. I'm not allowed to file by paper, but I have to have the only specs for the specimen were still the physical specs that you're supposed to send in. Because they didn't want you to actually send the box top. They wanted you to send a photograph of the box top. But you had to have the photograph on an 8x10 piece of paper. And I couldn't figure out how to attach an 8x10 piece of paper. Because it said specifically not to staple it. They've gotten better since then. Yeah.
Any legal ramifications for throwing a trademark logo or a copyright logo on something that's not trademarked or copyrighted? Like a photo of yours that you didn't file
for? It's copyrighted even if you haven't filed.
I mean, like.
So if you took the picture, you own the copyright to it, and you can put a copyright symbol on it. The trademark symbol, there are times when you can use it and times when you can't. And I don't want to give the specific rules because I didn't refresh those right before I came in here, and I will say a specific thing wrong and someone will go and break the law because of me. So I don't want, but the copyright logo, if you took the picture, you own it, put the C on it. There's no problem with that. Yeah.
You told us not to transfer ideas over, but copyright law stands as soon as it is in a big start. So same thing apply to trademark.
No. The question was when trademark protection begins. Copyright, as we mentioned, applies when the work is created and fixed in a tangible medium. Trademark your common law rights, which is the ones that are limited by geography and by other similar things. The non-federal registration rights begin only to the extent that you are using the mark in commerce. So it's not when you write down this cool logo, it's when you sell stuff with that logo attached. And the federal registration changed, I say recently, it was 20 years ago now. If you have the intent to use a particular logo or mark, you may register it now under the intent to use registration rather than the already in use registration. It used to be that you had to have it used in commerce. There are a lot of people who would ship themselves a box of something across the state line saying, there, it's in commerce, and file that way. You don't have to go through that subterfuge any longer. They admitted, okay, fine, intent to use, you have like 6 months something to actually use it. Yeah.
We were talking about pseudonyms earlier, a couple of questions came up. Is there any benefit to trademarking a pseudonym?
Sure. You'll then own the right to provide the services under that name. I mean, it's like a company name. You know, Coca-Cola is not someone's name. It's, in effect, a pseudonym. Are we?
Yeah, we need
clarify. I would encourage another question, but it occurs to me I'm probably not supposed to. Yeah. Well, I can do one more. You had a... Nope.
Websites or other information for more information.
Copyright
sites. The government sites are good. I'm leery of others. The Creative Commons folks I trust, they don't say things that aren't true. Most people do. Most places that you find people giving you free advice, I don't believe most of it because there are always some errors in it and you just don't know which they are. But the government sites are good.
Any books or...
The books that I use that I recommend are legal and kind of thick and not what you would want. I don't know off the top of my head a good copyright book for real people. I know several for lawyers. I should find one, but I don't off the top of my head know any that I can recommend. I should write one. But
make sure to copy.
Okay, thanks a lot.